All right, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Genesis. We left off in chapter 46. Okay, we're just now winding down this story about Joseph. And what's interesting about Joseph, there's a lot of interesting things about him, but actually Joseph, there's more written about Joseph and the life of Joseph than anybody else in the Old Testament. And I found that kind of hard to believe because I thought, well, there's got to be more written about David because, David is mentioned over 1,100 times in Scripture. But if you read, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Chronicles, 1 and 2 Kings, a lot of what's said about David is kind of redundant or overlaps or, it repeats itself. When you're reading about the life of Joseph, it covers an awful lot of ground. And he really is elevated, as one of the major characters in the Old Testament. And one of the things about Joseph, and I've said this time and time again, is the fact that he so thoroughly prefigured Jesus Christ in so many ways. I mean, from his birth, from the fact that he was a favorite of his father, to the fact that he was hated by his brothers, that he was sold for 20 pieces of silver, kind of prefiguring Christ, and he was given up for dead as he went down into Egypt. And his resurrection, Christ's resurrection, was kind of prefigured in him when he rose, going from, in a matter of minutes, from the dungeon to the throne. And then, as the birth, basically the prime minister, the ruler of Egypt, he kind of prefigured Christ, and he became basically the savior of the world through this famine. Okay, when all the world would come to him, that he had bread, and in the process, his brothers came down to get bread, and then he recognized them. They didn't recognize him. It's the same thing would happen to Christ, that his brothers, meaning the Jews, didn't recognize him for who he was. But then there was, a reconciliation between him and his brothers as he had forgave them for what they had done to him. All of this kind of prefigured Jesus. And now the word gets back to his father Jacob that Joseph is alive. And now Jacob is going to go down into Egypt to see his son Joseph. And he's about to make this journey. Okay, when we begin up with chapter 46. But this is all orchestrated by God. This is all God's plan, creating this famine and putting Joseph in the position of one of the most powerful men in the entire world to make all these decisions so that God can actually bring down Jacob and his family, which is only consists of about 70 people. And he's coming down here, actually, from Hebron, but here's Beersheba, where we're going to read about in a little bit tonight. But he goes into Egypt, and he goes into the land of Goshen. And when he get into that land, I think it's significant, because this, if you look at the Nile here, it branches off into a lot of different tributaries, and it really, even though it's a time of famine, it's still, the land of Goshen is very ideal for pasture land. And the people of Egypt, the Egyptians, loathe shepherds, are people who take care of their livestock or sheep. They're really beneath them. But that's all in God's plan too, because he wants his people isolated. And there, from 70 people, he's going to bring them up into a great nation. Because about 400 years from now, or from the time of Joseph, 400 years later, they're going to multiply into a peoples from 70 people to almost 3 million people at the time of the Exodus. Okay, this was all God's design. It's all God's plan. I'll hit upon it a little bit more before as we go along. But anyway, beginning with chapter 46, verse 1, it says, "So Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, 'Jacob, Jacob.' And he said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'I am God, the God of your fathers. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes.' Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives and their wagons, which Pharaoh had sent to carry him." Okay, actually, he's coming up from Hebron, and he comes down to Beersheba. This is just before he leaves the land of Cana. And what Jacob does is he offers a sacrifice to God there. In other words, he basically is praying and inquiring for God's will. What should I do? And I think he had a lot of apprehensions about going to Egypt. Why do you think he would have those kind of apprehensions? Pagan. Well, remember, it's the land of Cana that God had gave to him, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and to all of his followers. So, God didn't want him to leave the land. Okay, he was told, basically given orders to stay in the land. But now, because of the famine and because Joseph's down in Egypt, he really, you know, feels compelled to ask God for direction and guidance. So before he leaves the land, he offers sacrifice to God. And I think that that's very significant because, again, it's so important that we take, you know, that we really seek God's will. We seek God's guidance, his direction. We seek, you know, what he would have us to do in our lives. We just can't act upon our own understanding, like it says in Proverbs 3. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. He seeks God in worship and in prayer, okay? Because I think he's torn apart as to, well, I want to go see Joseph, and the famine is forcing us out of the land, and you know, but I want to know what God's will is. And then God is gracious to him. God appears to him in the night, tells him, hey, don't be afraid. Go down to Egypt, you know, and there I'm going to make you a great nation, and Joseph is going to close your eyes there, meaning that he's going to die in Joseph's presence. And, you know, how when a person dies, their eyes are very often opened, and, you know, Joseph's going to close them, so Joseph is going to be by his side. So all I'm saying is that, you know, you see the maturity slowly but surely come about in Jacob over many, many years, and now he's seeking God's will before he goes down there. And then it says in verse 6, and they took their livestock and their property which they had acquired in the land of Canaan and came to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, and his sons and his grandsons with him, and his daughters and his granddaughters and all of his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel, Jacob and his sons, who went to Egypt: Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and the sons of Reuben, Hanok and Palu and Hezron and Carmi, and the sons of Simeon, Jamiel and Jamin and Ohad and Jason and Zohar and Shaul, and the son of the Canaanite woman, and the sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, Merai, and the sons of Judah, Er, Onan, Shelah, and Perez, and Zerah. But Er and Onan died in the land of Canaan, and the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul, and the sons of Issachar, Tola, and Puvah, and Job, and Shimron, and the sons of Zebulun, Zered, and Elron, and Jael. These are the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in the Paddan Aram, with his daughter Dinah and all of his sons and their daughters, numbering 33. Okay, now, it's basically giving us a genealogy here that's basically coming from the mothers. Okay, they're breaking it up like these were all the descendants of Leah. Okay, now remember, Jacob had four wives, and these are the sons that she's given as far as the sons of Leah and their sons, or their grandsons. Okay, and like I said, I mean, you know, I hate going through these genealogies or trying to trip someone follow all over these names because I really don't have a gift for pronunciation, as you all know. But, you know, I don't want to skip anything of the scripture because it's put here for our instruction. It's put here for our edification, for our repute, for our understanding, for our example. And what it does tell me, you know, in an indirect sense is that here, even though 70 people are going down into Egypt, God does not deal in masses. In other words, he deals with individuals, okay? And he's setting forth a genealogy here that his ultimate purpose is to show us what line that Christ is going to come through, and he's going to come through the line of Judah, okay? But again, I think it's very significant that we understand this, that God really does deal with individuals. You know, he deals with us one-on-one. And Christ himself said, he says that the hairs of our head are numbered. That's always significant to me because it's not just like, you know, well, so we've got 250,000 pieces of hair or strands of hair. You know, some of it a lot less, but so whatever. But it's like, hey, this is number 3 and this is number 184,000. You know, it's like, you know, God has numbered each and every one of them. I mean, that's how intricate and how detailed he knows each and every one of us and how he deals with each and every one of us. And so he says here in verse 16, he says, and the sons of Gad were Ziphion and Haggai and Shunai and Esbon and Eri and Arodi and Ariel. It says the sons of Asher or Imnah and Ishva and Ishvi and Berea and the sister and their sister Sarah, and the sons of Berea, Heber and Malchael. And these are the sons of Zilpha, whom Laban gave to his daughter Leah, and she bore to Jacob these 16 persons. And the sons of Jacob's wife, Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. Now to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, and from whom Asenath, the daughter of of Potipharah, the priest of On, bore to him, and the sons of Benjamin, Rebela and Becher and Ashbel, and Gira and Naaman and Ehi and Rosh and Muppen and Huppen and Ard. And these are the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob. There were 14 persons in all. And the sons of Dan, Hushim, and the sons of Naphtali, Jashzeel, and Gunai, and Jazer, and Shelem. These are the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave to his daughter Rachel, and she bore these to Jacob. These were the 7 persons in all. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, were 66 persons in all, and the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. And also, you know, if you go back to the book of Acts, I think the 7th chapter, it says that there were 75 persons in all. It's not that there's a contradiction there. It's just that apparently they also included the grandchildren of Joseph, you know, to make a grand total of 75 people that were basically God was going to raise up as a nation in Egypt and then bring them out with a mighty hand. And then verse 28 says, Now he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen, and they came to the land of Goshen. Now here's another interesting thing. Is they're on their way down from Beersheba, and they're on their way over to Goshen. So when they get to the land of Goshen, what happens is that Jacob sends his son Judah to his son Jacob, or actually to Pharaoh, okay, to his son Joseph. He sends him there and to ask him, well, where do you want us to settle? Where should we go in this particular land? I think it's kind of significant that he uses Judah, because remember, the firstborn was Reuben, and the second, you know, was Simeon and Levi, and then Judah. Well, Reuben, even though he was firstborn, he basically lost his birthright because he defiled his father's couch. And then his other two eldest sons, which were Simeon and Levi, because of their anger, they had, you know, ended up slaying all the men in Shechem, and, you know, they basically lost favor with their father for what they did. So now Judah is becoming the trusted son, and God has really dealt with Judah. And remember, it's going to be through the line of Judah that Christ is going to come. And it was Judah who basically said to his father, listen, I'm going to be surety, I'm going to be a guarantee, or I'm going to be collateral, whatever you want to put it, you know, to make sure that, remember when he was going to go back into Egypt, that he was going to make sure that Benjamin, Jacob's youngest son, was going to come back to him. But you look what happened in the life of Judah. Judah had to be dealt with, and God dealt with him in many ways, because you can see he lost his son Er, he lost his son Onan, he lost his wife Shua. That God had been really dealing with him over the years. And we could see that when the last time that we were together for Bible study, we were reading about how Judah stood in and really pleaded on behalf of Benjamin. And, you know, I've often said that words are born, you know, in darkness, in trial, in error, in heartbreak, in disillusionment, in defeat. In other words, when a person usually goes through a lot in their life in terms of difficulties and setbacks and disappointments and, you know, bereavements or heartbreak, that person usually becomes a deep person. There's just far too many shallow people today. And I think one of the reasons there are so many shallow people is that they lack a depth because they have not been through a great deal. You know, people who have been through a great deal usually have a great deal of spiritual insight or depth to them that we could see beginning to blossom in Judah. And remember, it was just through Judah and through the line of Judah that Christ is going to come. So Jacob sends Judah on his way to Joseph to ask him where they're going to dwell in the land of Goshen. So beginning with verse 28. Now he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen, and they came to the land of Goshen. And Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. And Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive. And Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's households, I will go up to Pharaoh, and I will say to him, my brothers and my father's household, who were in the land of Canaan, have come to me, and the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And it shall come about that when Pharaoh calls you and says to you, what is your occupation? That you shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. Now, just a couple of points before we close this particular chapter is that Joseph prepares his chariot, and he goes to Joseph, and he sees his father. Now, how long has it been since he's seen his father? Anybody remember? It's been a good 22 years. He was 17 years old when his brothers, took him and threw him in that pit and then sold him to the Egyptians, or actually sold him to the Ishmaelites, who then took him down to Egypt and sold him into slavery. Okay, so he hasn't seen his father for 22 years. And he finally, when he meets his father, he just hugs him, and he just weeps for a long time. I mean, it's such an emotionally charged reunion. And, in a sense, to me, this kind of typifies a couple of things, okay? Is that Jacob represents Israel, okay, in this respect. What's going to happen when Christ comes back? We are told this in the book of Zechariah. He's going to come back, and his people rejected him 2,000 years ago. The overwhelming majority of the Jewish people have rejected him. But when he does come back to set up his millennial kingdom, it says in Zechariah that the Jews are going to weep for him as they weep for an only son. They're going to recognize him as being their Messiah, and there's going to be this very emotional reunion between Christ and his people. And you can also take it even a step further, that you can see there'll be a reconciliation in this. It's almost a prefigurement of the reconciliation that we will see when we, meet God the Father. In other words, it's been a long, long time span, okay, since Adam sinned in the garden, all right? And eventually there will be a total, complete reunion between God and man. It hasn't been achieved yet. It will finally have its climax when, in the book of Revelation, where John talks about the new heavens and a new earth, and he sees the Jerusalem coming down, and it's going to be, a massive city that's 1,500 miles wide in each direction and 1,500 miles high, and it will plant itself firmly in the land of Israel. Okay? And there it says that God will dwell with man. So you see this kind of a prefigurement of the reunion that's going to happen, okay, that's going to take place there. Then he says this, it's kind of significant, that after the meeting with his father, he turns to his brothers and basically says this: look, I'm going to introduce you to Pharaoh, and when I do, I want you to tell him what you are. Tell him you're shepherds, and that's all you've been all your life, okay? Because Joseph knows, okay, that their occupation makes them loathsome to the Egyptians, okay? And even that is in God's plan, all right? Because when they go before Pharaoh, if they were to say to Pharaoh, well, we're carpenters and we're masons and we're lawyers and we're doctors and we're physicians and we're this and that and the other thing, well, then Pharaoh's going to say to them, well, gee, I could use you here and I could use you there, and he's going to, incorporate them into his own system, right? His own society. But God has his own plans. First of all, they don't speak Egyptian, and second of all, they are loathsome to the Egyptians, so that just makes it all the more conducive for what? For them to become a people in this particular land, because they are separated from the Egyptians. And even that's significant, because what does the Bible tell us? He says, we are told that we are to be in the world, but what? Not of the world. So Egypt represents the world, and when God's people, even though we're in the world, we are really to be separated from the world. We're not to be of the world. We're not to have or maintain or hold the world's value systems and the world's way of thinking, the world's way of doing things. Okay? And the fact that they are loathsome to the Egyptians because they're shepherds, I think is a significant spiritual parallel too, because I think I mentioned this last week or the week before last, is the fact that a true born-again believer is an abomination to the world. There's no question about it. There's no question whatsoever about it. All you have to do is stand up and take a stand for Christ, an uncompromising stand, not a lukewarm, watered-down, wishy-washy, two-sided stands for Christ. But, I mean, you take a stand and you say, hey, there's a hell and there's sin and there's judgment. Okay? what these guys are going to be doing on Easter Sunday down there, you know, in the Castro district, marching around as the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence and having this hunky Jesus contest and all this, to stand up and say, hey, that's blasphemy. That's sacrilege. That's an affront to God. Well, the world's going to look on and say, well, you're just hateful. You're just bigoted. You're just an extremist. You know, you're just narrow-minded. And basically, you're dangerous. I mean, this is the way it's getting, isn't it, now? When you stand up and you take a stand for God and you say, hey, this is wrong and this is sin and this is going to bring judgment and so on and so forth, the world can't stand you. Okay? Stand up and take a stand against abortion or homosexuality or any number of things that is going on in this country today and see, you know, if the world doesn't hate you, if the world doesn't find you loathsome, if the world doesn't find you, you know, despicable. Well, that's where we're at today. But again, God has his reasons, he's got his plans, because it's the very fact that they are going to be isolated, you know, enables him to build them up as a unique people. Okay, he's taken that 70 people, 75 people in all, and he's going to transform them into a mighty nation. A nation that, as they grow in here, you know, in about 400 years, they are going to go from 75 people to almost 2.5 to 3 million people by the time of the Exodus when God leads them out of there. You know, which they would never have done if they got assimilated into Egypt. And the fact they would never have done if they got assimilated into the land of Canaan with the Canaanites. That's why God, in his infinite wisdom, brought them down here. And he did it all through his plan that he had for Joseph. Okay, anybody have anything to add or share to what we just read? Okay, let's quickly read this chapter 47. And it says, then Joseph went in and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen. And he took 5 men from among his brothers, and he presented them to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? So they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers. And they said to Pharaoh, we have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land, and let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know any capable men among them, then put them in charge of my livestock. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob. Okay, now before we go further, again, just he brings 5 of his brothers, basically representative of his family, and he brings them before Pharaoh. And then Pharaoh asks him the question, what is your occupation? And they tell him what he is, okay, what they are. Okay, and Joseph knew that if they told him the truth, just straight out, that it would be very conducive for them to just be, you know, left alone in the land of Goshen. And I think that that's kind of significant because, you know, we really do need to, as Christians, make our stand known. Make it known that we are Christians. A lot of people have this idea that, well, you know, my faith is just something personal. I don't really feel compelled to share it with anybody. Well, that's all fine and dandy, except for one thing. First of all, Jesus said, if you confess me before men, I'll confess you before the Father. If you deny me before men, I'll deny you before your Father. You know, if we confess him before men, he'll confess us before his angels in heaven. If we deny him before men, he's going to deny us before. So in other words, we do have to confess him before men, you know, like it or not. Now, you know, we really have to exercise some discernment. We have to exercise some wisdom. Jesus himself said, hey, you know, don't give what is holy to dogs, because what's going to happen is they're either going to turn on you, you know, or they're going to trample underfoot what you have to say. So you do have to use some wisdom. But the thing is, if you take a stand and let people know, listen, I'm committed to Christ, then, you know, you've closed the back door. In other words, you haven't left yourself an out. If you don't confess to anybody that, you know, that you are a follower of Christ, then it doesn't matter how you live. Okay, you can steal from your neighbor and cuss like a trooper and, you know, cheat on your wife. Do whatever you want to do. And nobody's really going to pull you on a carpet for it, right?
God will.
Right. But I'm just talking about man. But as soon as you make a claim that you're a follower of Christ, they'll be the first ones to lambaste you as being a hypocrite and a phony and a worthless good for nothing and so on and so forth, right? Okay? So you close the back door by making that known. But at the same time, you got to use some wisdom. You don't have to, you know, go out and and be obnoxious in your witnessing. As a matter of fact, I'll give you a hypothetical example. Let's just say that you're new on a job. Oh, you don't have to be new on a job. You can just simply be on your job. You know, a good way of witnessing, without ever saying a word, is bring your Bible to work, read it on your break, read it on your lunch hour, and all of a sudden, without saying a word, you have basically declared, you know, where you are. Okay? And when you know, in applying the same thing here, it's kind of like, you know, just telling people up front who you belong to or what your occupation is. But now it says in verse 7, it says, then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many years have you lived? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained to the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. Okay, before we go any further, Joseph brings his father Jacob to Pharaoh. And Jacob blesses Pharaoh. I think that's extremely significant because we always know that the greater blesses the lesser. Here Pharaoh is. He's the most powerful man in the known world. Okay? And yet he's blessed by Joseph's father. He's blessed by Jacob. That to me is very significant because Jacob, again, as Israel, he represents God's people. And if you look around the world and all you have to do is look through history and look at today, you will see that the world has definitely been blessed and is a much better place because of God's people. How many hospitals, how many schools, how many hospices, how many charitable organizations, how many charitable outreaches, how many soup kitchens, I don't care how many things have been, you know, basically started to help mankind in his need by Christians. You know? Only God knows the number. This world, as much as they hate Christ and as much as they hate his followers, you know, this world has been extremely blessed by the very people they hate. Isn't that true? I mean, look at how the world has been blessed by Mother Teresa. Okay? I mean, just as an example. And the reason they've been so blessed is why? Because of her commitment to Christ. Okay, beginning with verse 10, it says... Also, he said this, Jacob said, that the years of my sojourning are 130. He says his sojourning, he says that twice. Sojourning is his pilgrimage. Here Jacob is, he's 130 years old, but he's letting it be known that, hey, I'm just passing through. Right? Mm-hmm. And that's the truth. I mean, Jacob lived to be 147. And he basically, his lifespan is double the average lifespan of today. But the fact remains, you know, that he recognized that regardless of how long he lived, he's just a pilgrimage. I mean, if you look around today, and it's hard to see how people could really have that insight, isn't it? I mean, look at Madison Avenue, look at Hollywood, look at the value systems that are being, you know, projected upon all of us today. It's like people don't have a clue of what's really important, where we're really headed. I mean, you know, it's just amazing, isn't it? The values that we have. I mean, I didn't read this article, but I noticed on a newsstand there's the latest People article, People magazine, rather, that deals with all these eating disorders that are becoming almost epidemic with high school and college girls. You know, that a lot of them are starving to death so that they can look, you know, thin and they can somehow reach this ideal that the world has. This ideal that's presented is what? It comes from Madison Avenue. It comes from Hollywood. And probably less than 5% of the women in the world look like these models that they're, you know, churning out. That this is that kind of like, well, this is what you have to look like if you really want to have, you know, the absolute most self-esteem, or you really want to have success in life, or you really want to be attractive, and so on and so forth. When we see that, I mean, it's, at least when I see that, I can't help but think of what Solomon says, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. The eye is not satisfied with seeing or hearing, the ear is not satisfied with hearing. I mean, all is vanity, but man is not able to tell it. They don't recognize, they can't tell what's really of value, what's really of importance. And the fact remains that regardless of how good you look or how much money you have or how much fame you can acquire or how much influence or power or how much prestige or how long you may live, hey, the fact is, hey, you're just sojourning. You're just a pilgrim. This isn't the end. This isn't your final destination, you know. But how many people really recognize that, see that? Well, Jacob did. He said, and then he says this, I've lived 130 years. He's got another 17 years before he died. But he tells Pharaoh he's 130 years old. He says, my days have been few compared to my father's, but my days have also been very, very difficult. And you look at Jacob's life and you see a man who got, now look at the contrast between Jacob and Joseph, his son Joseph. Jacob, okay, we all know the story, is that the fact that he swindled his brother out of his birthright. He swindled his brother Esau out of his birthright. He lied to his father, okay? And then to save his life, because it was in danger, he ran up to Padan Aram, you know, hundreds of miles north. He never saw his mother again, apparently, because the scriptures kind of indicate that. But when he gets up there, God deals with him. He deals with him with his uncle Laban, because he gets up there, he sees this Rachel that he falls head over heels over, and he said that he will work 7 years, you know, to get her as a bride. So he works 7 years expecting to get Rachel. Instead, Laban gives her Leah. So now he has to work another 7 years to get Rachel. So he works 14 years in all to get Rachel, and then he works another 6 years to try to build up flocks for his household, and Laban ends up changing his wages 10 times until finally Jacob says, I can't take this more. I got to get out of here. So he leaves, and he's hightailing it down into Cana, and then Laban's following him. Esau is coming with 400 men to meet him, you know, and then God wrestles with him all night long, puts out his thigh, and now he's limping for the rest of his life, you know. And then finally, after meeting Esau, you know, he had to bow down 7 times to his brother, and he gives him a lot of what he accumulated up in Padan Aram just to be reconciled with his brother. And then shortly after that, there's what that incident where his daughter is raped, and then his sons end up killing all of the men of Shechem, you know. So they make an audience there, and he hightails it out of there. And then sometime between there, his wife Rachel dies. And that must have been a tremendous blow to him, no question about it. Okay, and then sometime after his wife died, his oldest son Reuben, you know, defiles his couch by going into one of his wives, okay, and sleeps with her. He finds out about that, and that must have really grieved him. That was his oldest son, how he did to him. And then after that, he loses his son Joseph. You know, he was lied to by his son, so he was tore apart by a wild beast. Okay, and then we read further on that sometime between all this happening and Joseph being sold into slavery, he loses his wife Leah. So he's had a long, hard life. Okay, and God has dealt with him over and over and over again. He's a slow learner. Contrast him with his son Joseph. Joseph is sold into slavery when he's 17 years old, and God fashions him, shapes him, molds him, disciplines him, and he definitely deals with him and changes him, you know, his inner character to where he becomes a tremendously great man. But his dealing with Joseph only took 13 years before he was catapulted into, you know, prominence. Jacob, here he is 130 years old, and he's still learning some hard lessons. My point is this, okay? I'm sorry about beating this around a bush, but it's just simply this. You know, I've seen over the years, okay, that some people can grow spiritually far more in 3 years than other people grow in 30 years. Have you seen it? I mean, I've seen it all the time. Why? Is it because God is giving this other person a lot more than the other? Why is it that one person can seem to grow spiritually and grow in such depths spiritually over a relatively short period of time, and other people, year after year, decade after decade, they don't seem to mature at all? What's the big difference?
Time is spent with God and how serious they take knowing God?
Yeah, basically it's just, hey, you know, do they really hunger after God? Do they really seek God with their whole heart, mind, soul, and strength? Like the psalmist says in the Psalms, my soul pants for thee as a deer pants for water. Okay? Is God such a driving ambition in your life? Is he such the number one importance in your life that you really pursue him with all your heart? You know, or is he just one more thing in your life that you just say, well, you know, you get around to it because TV is more important, or this is more important, this sport's more important, this is activity more important, or whatever. See what I'm saying? I think that the person who really hungers after God and seeks God with their whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, that person is going to grow in leaps and bounds. They might not see it themselves, but they are definitely growing in leaps and bounds comparison to other people who just seem to just, you know, make so little progress over so long a period of time. You know, and I think that's what you can see contrasted with Jacob and with his son Joseph. Anyway, moving on, it says, verse 10 says, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them possession in the land of Egypt and the best of the land in the land of Ramesses as Pharaoh had ordered. And Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all of his father's household with food according to their little ones. Now, there was, okay, now Joseph just takes care of his family. Remember, we also told in 1 Timothy chapter 5, it says that one who doesn't provide for his own household is worse than what? An infidel, an unbeliever. Well, here Joseph is providing for his own family and all of them. And in a way, Joseph prefigures Christ, that, you know, Christ will provide all of our needs, you know, no question about it. And he says in verse 13 says, now there was no food in all the land because the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us food, for why should we die in your presence? For our money is gone. Then Joseph said, give up your livestock, and I will give you food for your livestock, since your money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for his horses and the flocks and the herds and the donkeys, and he fed them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. And when that year was ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my lord that our money is all spent, and the cattle are my lord's. There is nothing left for my lord except our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. So give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every Egyptian sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. Thus the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the other. Only the land of the priest he did not buy, for the priest had an allotment from Pharaoh, and they lived on the allotment which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore they did not sell their land. And Joseph said to the people, behold, I have today bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, that you may sow the land. And at the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and a four-fifths shall be for your own seed of the field, and for your food, and for those of your household, and for the food of your little ones. So they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves. And Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt to this day that Pharaoh should have a fifth of fifth. Only the land of the priest did not become Pharaoh's. Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt and Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, and the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. And when the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, please, if I have found favor in your sight, now place your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear to me. So he swore to him. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed. Now, just, you know, this kind of gives an overview of what happened during the famine. And every year it became more and more severe, and the people ran out of money because they gave it all to Pharaoh in order to have food. But then, when they ran out of money, then they came to him and they gave him his livestock for food. And then after that, they gave him their land for food. So they were totally impoverished. And basically, Pharaoh ended up owning everything, including them, including portions of their land. But I think that that also has kind of a significance, too, because, you know, everything's going to end up reverting back to God. Because, Paul told us in Corinthians, he said, "For since by a man came death, by a man also came the resurrection of the dead. And as in Adam all died, so also in Christ all shall be made alive, but each in his own order. Christ the first fruits after those who are Christ at his coming. Then comes the end, when he delivers up the kingdom to God the Father, when he has abolished all rule and all authority and all power, for he must reign until he has put all of his enemies under his feet. The last enemy that will be abolished is death, for he has put all things in subjection under his feet. But when he says all things that are put in subjection, it is evident that he is expected to put all things in subjection to him. When all things are subjected to him, then the Son himself will also be subjected to the one who subjected all things to him, that God may be all in all." You know, that's kind of just a prefigurement of what's going to happen in the end. In other words, everything came back to Pharaoh. And in a sense, you know, it's going to all come back to God through Christ. Everything is going to be made, you know, brought back into order, and everything's going to be subjected unto God. That's why, you know, it's so asinine, it's so foolish, it's the epitome of ignorance and stupidity for anyone, to reject Christ. Because the Bible says anyway that there's coming a day when every tongue shall confess and every knee shall bend. Okay, whether that they're in heaven, on earth, or in hell, every living creature, when I say living creature, every human being and every angel or every devil is going to have to confess that. You know, the thing is, we can either do it now or you can do it later in hell, but it's going to be too late in hell. But nevertheless, you're going to do it, you know, because all is going to end up reverting back to the Father through Christ and what he has done. One last point before we close, okay? Jacob asked Joseph, okay, to swear to him that when he did die, that he would take his body and not bury it in Egypt, but he would take it back up to Canaan and bury it with his fathers. He would bury it with Abraham and with Isaac and with his dead wife Leah and up there with them. And he swore to him that he would. And I think that's kind of significant because Jacob, you know, has gotten to the point now in his earthly pilgrimage where he doesn't want the world to have any claim on it, not even his dead body. And I think that says a lot about his spiritual maturity over the years. Does anybody have anyone to add or share?